This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Judd Apatow takes inspiration from Pete Davidson's life in The King of Staten Island, while Elizabeth Moss confirms she's a genre unto herself in Shirley.
Andrew, last week I asked you, what is Judd Apatow? And I implored you to feel Bill Burr bald with a mustache. Lo and behold, here we are a week later, and we have The King of Staten Island under our belts, and I really think that we're worse off for it, unfortunately. Judd Apatow, I really hate to be one of those, like, you know, his best movie was his first one, but honestly, like, the further into his career that we get in this this fake Terms of Endearment stuff and, James L. Brooks stuff that he puts out really just doesn't sit right with me because he doesn't really have a good handle on drama. And, you know, he always kind of undercuts his own dramatic tension in scenes by peppering in these, you know, those stupid little Judd Apatow jokes that just like stick out like a sore thumb. The film's greatest asset, obviously, is Pete Davidson. Pete Davidson's been kind of having a moment of celebrity over the past few years. So it just made sense that he would eventually transition into leading man. And I guess if nothing else, Judd Apatow is a good director to kind of bridge that gap between, you know, tabloid fodder SNL star Pete Davidson and genuine actor Pete Davidson. This is kind of it's co-written by Pete Davidson. I'm sure he did the treatment and everything like that and came up with this story. But it's loosely based on his life, in which his father, who in real life was a firefighter who was killed on September 11th. In this film, it's just a more, you know, more routine fire, I guess you could call it. But it's just showing how that kind of informed his life from that age when his father died when he was 7 years old, all the way into adulthood, and how he developed borderline personality disorder because of it. And, you know, I'll get it right out of the way. I think that this is probably the most accurate depiction of borderline personality disorder that I've ever seen on camera. And I mean, that kind of thing has to be intentional. Like, it's obviously coming straight from the heart. So you get that really raw depiction. And there are so many great scenes where Pete Davidson is kind of giving into those impulses and into those moments of crisis and into those explosions of anger, and how he's unable to really reconcile that with his day-to-day life and how it completely stunts him. That's where the film's bread and butter is. When it's into this story of, and obviously, you know, it's kind of weird to say that, like, the depiction of it is the best part because the plot relies so heavily on it. And obviously his mother, played by Marissa Tomei, is kind of left to kind of take care of him and run the household after the daughter, played by Maude Apatow, one of Judd Apatow's daughters, who is the sister, goes off to college, and it's basically just Pete Davidson and his mom, played by Marissa Tomei once again. And then there's this weird set piece where Pete Davidson begins to tattoo on this little kid, comes to find out that it's Bill Burr's character's kid, and then Bill Burr is also a firefighter, but then he feels bad for yelling at Marissa Tomei after finding out what he did, so he takes her out for coffee, and then romance ensues, and there's really no, like, it just jumps from one point to another with a romance, and you don't necessarily give it any time to breathe, so it never quite feels authentic, and the scenes themselves are just, like, so turgid and boring in that way that only Judd Apatow can do in this aimless way, and, you know, you're just, like, kind of in between snarky jokes with these types of movies lately. And I'm thinking back to, like, Trainwreck, the one with Amy Schumer from a few years ago. I felt almost more or less the same way. I just think it's the really contrived plots. And I appreciate what he's going for and that he's trying to go into a more thoughtful realm of filmmaking. But, like, Robert Elswit is a cinematographer on this film. And it just feels like, I don't want to say it's a wasted opportunity, but it feels like he's trying to punch above his weight because a lot of Judd Apatow really doesn't have, like, a distinct visual style. So Robert Elswit has to do essentially all of the heavy lifting, and with no guidance and collaboration behind that, it doesn't necessarily stand out as something that's super distinctive. And for a guy of that caliber, that just kind of seems like a missed opportunity. And I don't want to feel like I'm completely dumping on the film because obviously some of it is kind of funny. I mean, Judd Apatow is a funny guy. We just talked about Walk Hard a couple weeks ago and how it's still incredibly hilarious 13 years later. But something is just missing in this transition when he's trying to go into serious filmmaking, and it's leaving me feel cold. And I just think his movies go on forever. Once, like, a brand new story starts three quarters of the way through the movie, the entire third act of the film is, like, almost 50 minutes long. It's just absolutely absurd how he can drag this stuff out and just, like, essentially try to tell, like, a story that would probably be better served in a longer television format. And maybe that's the overarching issue here. Maybe that would allow him to kind of find his groove with the drama that he's trying to mine. But even still, these movies are almost 2.5 hours long. Something's got to give with this. And for me, this is just another misfire, even though there are elements of promise and something that I always appreciate, the appropriate and accurate portrayal of mental illness.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I made some of my thoughts on Judd Apatow well known at the end of our previous episode, and safe to say all my worst fears were confirmed. And not that I think this is a terrible movie by any stretch. It was, you know, just kind of there while I was watching it most of the time. I do think Pete Davidson is quite good, and I'll even give, you know, Bill Burr a solid. You know, I thought he was, you know, solid in a different way. It's a different Bill Burr than I think, you know, you expect. And, you know, I'll give him credit where credit's due. But, you know, I think the thing is, you know, and a lot, I've heard this, you know, a bit where people are like, oh, give credit to Judd Apatow for trying something different. Did he? Did he really try something different? Because, yes, tonally, it's certainly, you know, different. It's not, you know, a straight up comedy from him for sure. But I think you could argue that there's films like This Is 40 wasn't really going for, you know, a straight up, you know, comedy tone for sure. But it is another in these long line of, you know, basically these are the only types of projects he directs almost, you know. This Is 40 was almost like a biography, whereas, you know, pretty much all his other projects are, you know, it's a long line of a comedian star. You know, it's a vehicle for them. You know, they're typically a man child, or in the case of Amy Schumer, whatever you call the version of that on the female side. But I think the thing with Judd Apatow is, and I talked about this a bit, you know, last week, is that, you know, I think he can be a good writer. He has good moments. I think he can be a good producer. And, you know, I think a lot of, you know, I think the problem is he's just not a very good director. And I think, you know, this is the thing. Look at his filmography. All the stuff, most of the stuff he produced or co-wrote and didn't direct, almost all those films are so much better than all the stuff he did direct. And I still can't believe, like you mentioned, that this film is almost 2.5 hours long. And look, I'm not a big believer that a director should, like, completely listen to, you know, all the critics or criticisms of themselves. But how by this point in his career has he not done some self-reflection and realized that his films are way too damn long? I just don't get it. And the thing is, this is to his film's detriment. I bet if you cut a half hour out of this movie, I bet it coalesces into something that's a lot more meaningful. And, you know, and I think the problem is, you know, most of the film does feel really meandering and aimless. And, you know, you could make that argument, oh, isn't that kind of the point? Isn't that what our protagonist of Pete Davidson is doing? You could say that's the point, but I've seen this one too many times from Judd Apatow that I know a lot better, you know. And I, like I said, I think Davidson and Burr are both, you know, good in the film. And I think the third act, you know, like you said, it is certainly overlong, but there are at least some scenes there where you're getting to the heart of the film and you're understanding, all right, I at least kind of get what he's going for. But it just felt slightly too late, you know. It was just like, you know, it was so meandering and aimless for so long that it was hard to, you know, really feel something in those scenes when, you know, he didn't really do the necessary work, or just his film was so long that his message got completely lost in the shuffle of all of these events, you know. And I actually had hope for this film because I thought the opening sequence was quite memorable with Pete Davidson in the car, and he just slightly closes his eyes and he just like gets in a sort of slight crash, and I almost related to that in some way. I'm like, oh, maybe this is going to be an interesting exploration. And then just the next couple hours, you know, it's just meandering all around. It was weird seeing the great Belle Powley as a girl from Staten Island. You know, I'm a fan of her as an actress, you know, from Diary of a Teenage Girl, which she gave it a really incredible performance. And it's just weird seeing her in this accent. You know, she's better than this. Not that, you know, she's fine in the film, but, you know, it's just sort of like there would be many other projects that would use her much better. And, you know, she's only in, you know, a few scenes in the film as it is. You know, we've got all these weirdo Staten Island friends, so I'm sure are based on random people that Pete Davidson, you know, knew. And, you know, all this, you know, for a film called The King of Staten Island, what it really makes me want to do is stay the hell away from Staten Island for the most part. You know, there's weird moments in the film. There's like Pete Davidson works at this restaurant, and then all of a sudden they're doing a fight night for tips. It was just weird. And then the one element I did like about the film And it was really a small element. It was simple, but I thought it was effective, and I wish there was more of it. Was there's this simple thing where Bill Burr, when he starts dating Pete Davidson's mother, played by Marissa Tomei, and I'll get to that in a second. But you know, he basically forces Pete Davidson into walking his kids to school. And there was something about, I don't know, something about Pete Davidson's interactions with the kids. I thought there was a bit of energy there, and it was just something different. And I thought that was something the film could have capitalized in, but it doesn't quite go anywhere. And clearly it's only a setup for Bill Burr late in the film to be like, oh, the kids really like him, so maybe I should like him too. You know, it was just sort of like, oh, you could have done something more with this. There's a weird, you know, robbery thing, you know, with Robert Schmeichel as the owner of this store. And I was like, what the hell? What the hell is this? I don't understand the point of this. You know, basically the Staten Island Friends, you know, group. That basically subplot really doesn't go anywhere, other than to set a baseline for what Pete Davidson's life is. You know, he's sort of this inconsistent tattoo artist, and he's giving all these horrible tattoos, but then he's drawing art, and he, you know, for the kid, and he's, and it's a great picture. So I don't know. It's just sort of like, I think a lot of this stuff just gets lost in translation because Judd Apatow desperately needs someone to cut down his films, or at least he needs to let them cut down his films, because I have to imagine that all the editors he's worked with, and maybe, you know, it's a long time editor that he's worked with, but I have to imagine that these editors have recommended cutting down his films at a certain point, and he's just like, oh no, that's not really what I'm going for. But getting to the Marissa Tomei of it all, you know, I think you mentioned, Ryan, in your thoughts, you mentioned Marissa Tomei as the mom again, you know, and this is interesting because she gave a recent interview. And she said that she regrets embracing these mom roles because now that's all she gets. You know, she as soon as she embraced being Aunt May, this is what she's been subjected to. And she admitted that she's embraced it. And she's certainly, a great actress who is capable of so much more. And don't get me wrong, I think she's perfectly, you know, capable in this film. But she doesn't get much more to do than that. And I think it's, you know, just, you know, sort of unfortunate. I think she has a few sort of biting moments with Pete Davidson where she really jumps off the screen. But there's just not enough of it. And hopefully, Marissa, I'm praying for you that you can get out of this and, you know, be able to break, you know, this curse and get on to, you know, roles that aren't going to, you know, hamper you, you know, in this way or keep you in this box. And, you know, like I said, I thought the third act had some good stuff, but overall, it's just another one of these Judd Apatow films. And I think you're right when you say, yeah, his first directorial effort in The 40-Year-Old Virgin is definitely his best. You know, I will say, you know, I didn't dislike Trainwreck. In fact, I think it was, I have to say, I thought it was shorter than most of his films. Maybe I'm mistaken. I didn't go and look it up, but I could have sworn that it was shorter, and I think it worked as a result of it. But I thought that film at least had kind of a different perspective and energy to it, and some good supporting turns from people like Bill Hader and even LeBron, of all people. But this is just, you know, it's another one of these overlong things, and it's unfortunate because I think Pete Davidson, you know, has proven himself to be quite a good actor, and I think this will lead him, hopefully, to have a better career and better projects. But I just think overall, and I'm glad this meant something to him to tell at least part of his story, but I just think overall, it just never really comes together in anything that's really that meaningful.
The cynic in me would say that it kind of feels like Judd Apatow, like someone got in his ear back when the 40-Year-Old Virgin came out that he was on the cusp of nabbing a Best Original Screenplay nomination, and he spent the rest of his career chasing that. So his films have included, like, you know, when I say more mature themes, I guess, like, you know, less, you know, stoner comedy, trying to get laid stuff as they progress. And this is just kind of the natural progression of that, unfortunately. And to touch on Marissa Tomei, and again, I want to say that it's just purely me being cynical. I'm not sure it's actually the reason, but it does seem like he's going more in like a prestige territory. With Marissa Tomei, I'm a big fan of hers in general, and I think she's so good, and she does bring a layer of warmth to the proceedings, and it gives it a little bit more meat on the bones, as it were. But and she's always been a very demonstrative, hard-on-her-sleeve kind of performer, so, you know, you feel it a little bit more than you would have if someone less capable and, you know, a less capable performer. But I don't, it is kind of a sad, thankless role that she's transitioning into, because anyone, I mean, I know she's kind of a joke because of My Cousin Vinny, which is unfair because that movie's still kind of funny. I saw it, probably right around the time we started this podcast, was on Stars or something. She's very funny in it. I think she's awesome in Slums of Beverly Hills. She was incredible in The Wrestler. And she's still pretty good here. But, you know, it's just that it's typecasting. Hollywood does this to older women, and it's a goddamn shame because she can definitely turn it loose. But, you know, it's just as far as The King of Staten Island overall, you mentioned you would never want to go to Staten Island. I never wanted to go in the first place, to be honest, so I guess I'm ahead of the curve on that one. But, you know, he does kind of populate the world with some kind of funny and interesting characters, and it's definitely a case of less is more, I'll say. There are two musical cameos in this that I really appreciated. The first one was from Machine Gun Kelly, is kind of like the owner of a tattoo parlor that Pete Davidson is trying to get an apprenticeship at. And he's just a total, you know, smarmy dick. And it's just really fun just watching him just basically chastise Pete Davidson for even having the gall of showing up in there. And then later in the film, we have the immortal Action Bronson, who I think is one of the funniest fucking people on the planet, who shows up as either a shooting or stabbing victim. It's never exactly clarified which. But he really does make the most of his screen time. And unfortunately, that's kind of used as a launching point to get us to the emotional catharsis of the film, which I won't even bother explaining because it's too long-winded. And, you know, we even get like Dominic Lombardozzi is in this, for those of you who remember him in The Wire as Herc. He's in this. Minimal screen time. Fun to see him. Jimmy Tatro and Lou Wilson, two guys who were in a show that I really liked, American Vandal, which is still on Netflix. Both of whom show up and make very little use, as much as they can on their limited screen time. Jimmy Tatro, you might remember as Alice and Jenny's son from, Bad Education that came out earlier this year, kind of like the unwitting contractor, as it were. So hopefully, you know, he continues to get more mainstream stuff because he's a really funny guy. And again, I just implore you, please check out American Vandal. It's a quick watch and it's a lot of fun. But see, I'm already so far off track because this movie is just like completely uninteresting to me at this point. So I'm done. I don't know if you have anything else to say.
Yeah, I will just echo your thoughts. I really did enjoy the Action Bronson sequence. Like, it doesn't really, like, you know, have a major point other than to get the characters to go to the hospital to be able to see Marissa Tomei, who works there. But I really did enjoy Action Bronson. I think I'm immune to Machine Gun Kelly because, if you recall, I reviewed and talked about a previous Pete Davidson vehicle just a couple months ago. And Machine Gun Kelly there had a larger role in that film as one of Pete Davidson's friends. Although I did like that he was used differently here and he wasn't just put in that. They could have easily just put him in that Staten Island friend group. And I like that it was just a simple role in terms of that. But obviously they're friends, so it seems like they're just going to continue. They're going to be making movies together forever. And you also didn't mention Steve Buscemi, who is in this. He's in it's a small role, but a meaningful role as a firefighter. For those of you who don't know, you know, Steve Buscemi, I know, you know, post 9/11, I know he's always had an affinity for being a firefighter, and I know he's actually served as a firefighter. I believe post 9/11 he did, in fact, and I think he still fills in on occasion, so it's a passion of his. So it was nice to see him, you know, in a small, you know, but, you know, I guess I would say a meaningful role in that. But overall, you know, like I said, I didn't hate it, you know, definitely me railing on it. It's just like, I'm just so frustrated with Judd Apatow as a director at this point. And please, Judd, I implore you to go a different direction, but I think that's the unfortunate thing, because some people, you know, really like this film or think it's like something special, but I'm just immune to it just because I've seen Judd Apatow so much that I know what he does. And even though this may be different tonally for him and there are some good performances, please, man, just cut your films by half hour. And like I said, it's only going to help you in the long run. And I think this film would get an even greater critical reception if he did just that. But with that in mind, we can transition. We're going to talk briefly a bit about some of the news. First off, I'll just mention offhand, obviously, you know, the big films have been pushed back again. Both Tenet and Mulan have been pushed back into August, obviously, given the current state of the world. And as a result, I know some theaters are choosing not to open until, you know, then. And that's good. You know, it's good to play it safe. And, you know, there's not really much more to say about it than that. But we are going to talk about, you know, one of the bigger news stories of the past couple of weeks, which was the passing of the great Joel Schumacher. Of course. And, you know, when I think of Joel Schumacher, my mind instantly goes to where a lot of people's go. which is Batman and Robin. But, you know, that is unfair, I think, in a lot of ways, just because, you know, it is a terrible film. And he himself has admitted, you know, there's a great, I saw on Twitter, there's a great clip when News of Passing made the rounds. There's this great clip circulating on Twitter of his commentary for the film, and how he said that basically he wanted to make something darker, and how he's a fan of some of the graphic novels and wanted to use Batman Forever, which is a much better film, as sort of a jumping off point to make something much darker. And you could see some of that in Batman Forever, although it's not completely there. But, you know, Warner Brothers basically insisted that we need more toys, and he pretty much admits that on the commentary that, oh, I forget, he had a great term. They said, I never heard this term before, but we're just going to toyicize or whatever. I forget what the exact term this movie, and I love how he's very tongue-in-cheek you know, about it. But I also think of, you know, stuff like, you know, the great A Time to Kill, where yes, they deserve to die, and I hope they burn in hell. One of the all-time great movie quotes from Samuel L. Jackson, and that also was a springboard, and Matthew McConaughey said as much for, you know, when he was very much unknown. This was post Dazed and Confused, but obviously he wasn't known from Dazed and Confused. He's only known now that he's a famous actor. But that was sort of a big, you know, time to put him in a leading role, and that led to his, you know, long career. And of course, I have to mention The Lost Boys, of course. You know, Kyle would kill me if I didn't mention it here. You know, he's obviously, he made a lot of, you know, infamous, you know, 80s films. He had a lot of collaborations with Kiefer Sutherland. Even, you know, I have to mention Phone Booth, a film that got a lot of play for me, you know, when it was released, for sure. I remember I owned it on VHS, which is just weird to say. It's a weird statement to say. You know, I just think about, you know, Lost Boys and all of that. And it's just weird. You know, I will give Joel Schumacher a lot of credit. His career is very varied, and while he's gone from, you know, good films to, like, really terrible ones, you know, I think that happens with a career as varied as his, and someone who is willing to take chances. And I think, you know, I certainly think the film landscape is a lot less vibrant without him, to say the least.
I saw someone on Twitter pay the best tribute possible to him by saying that he was the pioneer of cinematic bisexual lighting. And I think that is pretty much the most apt way you could describe his output, particularly with the Batman films. There's like this homoerotic subtext underneath. You mentioned how like Warner Brothers just kind of wanted the toys as the forefront in the marketing and the merchandising. And God knows I still have both Batman Forever and Batman and Robin McDonald's drinking glasses somewhere in my parents' house. But he took it in the extreme direction. I think there was a subversiveness to it. And you mentioned that he's willing to take chances. I think he's willing to fuck with the studio sometimes, too. There was no other reason for the cod pieces and bat nipples. It was absolutely brilliant. But just the way that he crafted these, you know, that nightmarish vision of Gotham that I still can't get out of my head. You know, but Nolan's just looks like Chicago and Pittsburgh because that's where they're filmed. But the Batman movies actually have like some vision and some, you know, like just the use of colors, and Stephen Goldblatt's photography is so good in that. And he really, it's like a complete vision. Everyone shits on him because the movies were terrible. That had studio interference for all that. Everything that we hated about it, that was all studio interference. Joel Schumacher was just like amping it up to the nth degree. He knew what he was doing. And it's just like so beautiful to watch that play out. Both of his Batman movies are a lot of fun to me, mostly for nostalgia's sake. But again, you know, age is kind of bad movies. I think Batman and Robin can be watched as an out-and-out classic nowadays. It's just, it's funny to watch how time has been kind in that respect. But you mentioned The Lost Boys. That movie is absolutely incredible. Saxophone solo, absolutely iconic. Falling Down with Michael Douglas came out in 1992, which is still, unfortunately, oddly prescient nowadays. It's basically
I haven't seen it.
Oh, yeah. It's fucking good. He just basically loses his job and then goes nuts in Southern California. It's uncomfortable, but it's definitely worth revisiting because it was one of those movies I watched with my parents as a kid. They rented the VHS once, and I was just like, I felt like I was getting away with something because there was so much profanity and violence in it. But I remember, like, very distinctly, that was the first time I saw my parents laughing at violence on screen. So, like, it was just a really eye-opening moment that Joel Schumacher afforded to me to see how movie violence especially even when it's being depicted, when what is being depicted is horrible, can still actually be kind of tongue-in-cheek funny. And I will always appreciate that, because that has kind of informed my sense of humor with movies going forward. But Joel Schumacher, you were a real one, and thank you for fighting the good fight.
Yeah, and I just briefly wanted to mention a film that I haven't seen of his, but I know a lot of people always, you know, gave it a recommendation, which is his film Tigerland. It's a war film starring Colin Farrell, which led to their collaboration on Phone Booth, a completely different, apparently, in tone film. And so one of these days, you know, maybe I'll finally get around to checking that out, because I've always heard good things from quite a few people. And also, I do recommend, you know, but I would say, you know, oh, this isn't the time when talking about the passing, you've got to talk about this, but this is what a lot of people were talking about. Check out some of his interviews and his openness about his sexual proclivities, because it is really wild to hear him talk about, like, the insane amount of partners he's had, and he was very open about it as well. So I think, you know, if you really want to get look at him in a completely different way, I think that's something that was really interesting, and the fact that he was such an open guy with that and just didn't really care. And I think that's something that, you know, hey, you know, there's a lot of filmmakers who care too much and never, you know, amount to much, or never have, you know, a clear vision or perspective. And it's safe to say that could not be said of the great Joel Schumacher. But with that in mind, we're going to transition to our second film of the episode. And this is a film called Shirley, from director Josephine Decker. And, you know, I mentioned in the intro that, you know, Elizabeth Moss essentially is a genre unto herself at this point. You know, crazy Elizabeth Moss is my favorite genre at this point. You know, I talked about in our favorite films of the decade, I talked about some of her performances. I saw this amazing, I could call it two separate performances. You know, when I last went to TIFF in this film, Her Smell, where it's a film of two halves, where she's insane and unhinged in one half, and then she's gentle and intimate in the second half. It is, like, really worth checking out, you know, but it is a very abrasive film. But, you know, she's an actress that just, I mean, it's just insane. You know, obviously we're both big fans of her as Peggy Olson on Mad Men, and it is just so heartening to see what she's done with her career and able to make these very harshly independent films and really, you know, use them as a springboard for just really great and powerful and really difficult performances, to say the least. But essentially, this film, Shirley, it centers on a young couple, played by Logan Lerman and Odessa Young, who move in with a professor, played by the great Michael Stuhlbarg of A Serious Man fame. I'll always know him from A Serious Man, one of my favorites. And his mentally unstable, recluse horror writer wife, the titular Shirley, played by Moss. You know, and Rose, who is played by Odessa Young, is tasked with, you know, keeping the house during Shirley's bouts of instability in writing. You know, Rose, she soon learns that she's pregnant, which Shirley somehow senses without knowing, and this leads to a really interesting relationship between the two women. Essentially, Odessa Young is essentially our protagonist, you know, in this film, and we see a lot of this journey through her. And essentially, you know, Logan Lerman, I wasn't sure the exact relationship, but essentially he feels like a TA to Michael Stuhlbarg, or he's trying to be a, you know, a faculty member, you know, on this, college campus, which seems to be an all-women's college. Jeez, what could go wrong there? But, you know, essentially, you know, there's a lot of, you know, mentions of you know, different, you know, sexual escapades on the behalf of professors. But it really is just a vehicle for, you know, both Odessa Young, who I thought was really great in her lead role, and Elizabeth Moss, and their sort of growing friendship, relationship, whatever you want to classify it as. But there's a lot of great dialogue in this film. I just absolutely love this film, to be honest. There's lots of great lines. Elizabeth Moss has a line early in the film where she says, "A clean house is evidence of mental inferiority," which is just, I don't know, the film is just full of lines like that that just, like, make you think about your life or think about the world in a different light, to say the least. But essentially, Her character, Shirley, you know, she starts writing about this missing college girl who went missing on the campus, and she envisions Odessa Young's character of Rose. She envisions her as this girl, and she starts sending Rose on research missions, and, you know, their relationship is, like I said, the most sort of the main focus of the film, and it's also really intriguing. But there's also, you know, this weird marital situation between Moss and Stuhlbarg, where Stuhlbarg's character of Stanley, you know, he's a professor, and you know, he sort of treats her like a child almost at times. And it's just like, it's really weird. Some of the scenes are both like, both, you know, underratedly funny, but also powerful in a way. It's almost, you almost don't know what to think at different times. And that's what makes the film, you know, so engaging. And a lot of these characters walk sort of a specific tightrope. And then Rose and her relationship, their relationships are sort of reflections of each other, where she becomes jealous of Logan Lerman's character, Fred, who's spending so much time on campus with these female students. There's also this section of the film that I really loved, and I was laughing throughout it, where Stuhlbarg is resistant to Lerman wanting to take over one of his lectures, and he talks about how he's jealous of his youth and vigor, and he says it's entitlement, and he's like, you know, and he's just like acting crazy, where like after Lerman like gives a lecture and it seems not to be going well, then we cut to them at home and Michael Stuhlbarg's going crazy in like celebration, and it almost made me think, is he as crazy as Shirley, or perhaps crazier? You know, I think that's the thing, where it plays with your expectations for some of these characters and presents them in a certain way, but makes you question your initial instincts on them. For sure. But I thought the characters were really, you know, interesting. Like I said, there's a lot of great lines and I could go on and on, but I'll turn it over to Ryan as of right now.
So as someone who, like, and I felt stupid because I watched a trailer and didn't even realize this was a biopic until it was about halfway through, that Shirley Jackson is actually the author of Haunting of Hill House. That was like, I was outright embarrassed of shame on me for that one. But, you know, we had Elizabeth Moss as, well, in The Invisible Man a few months ago, and that she was just fantastic in that. And that still stands as one of the best performances of the year. And obviously, Shirley is just another notch in her belt on that front. But I'd even put this one ahead of her work in The Invisible Man. I think it's a more interesting and unique set of circumstances that the character is given to work and given to work with, and what she is given to work with as an actor, and just watching her, you know, go from like that, like silently judging, conniving type in one moment to just like this, almost like disinterested, distant, almost dissociative caricature that just like kind of rambles through the halls and spits out mean-spirited things at everyone just for the sake of it. It's incredible work, but you never hate her. And that's kind of the weird thing about it, because she's definitely not, doesn't do a single likable thing throughout the entire film. But it is really just fascinating watching like the verbal back and forth and the verbal battles that she has with Odessa Young and Michael Stuhlbarg. And Michael Stuhlbarg, is just one of my favorite actors. I've always loved him from A Serious Man. I thought that is just such an underrated performance. We had him a couple of years ago on the podcast in Call Me By Your Name, in which it was he played an academic college professor type, admittedly a much friendlier face. But in here, you know, you mentioned that like he has these histrionic outbursts that aren't too dissimilar from Shirley's. But you do, I wonder if like his is more kind of like a fake conniving thing that he was going for. It's like, it's really interesting how the film keeps you on your toes. And even like these kind of semi-suspense sequences, like there's one where Odessa Young's character goes to the post office and interviews Robert Wool, of all people, about like just his whereabouts and knowledge of the girl that disappeared. It's just like, there's so many balls in the air that are being juggled, and you want to talk about svelte runtimes. This is only an hour and 47 minutes, and I think that's fairly svelte, but what they were able to cram into it and what they were able to mine out of it, and a lot of that is just credit to the actors. I think Josephine Decker is a very, very fine filmmaker, and she uses so many different camera angles. Like there's one towards the end of the film where the camera just like kind of twists in a really weird direction that's very disorienting, but at the end of the day, it's really the performances that kind of get to the heart of what we're actually going after here, because this is very much a cold and impersonal story. Well, I shouldn't say impersonal, but certainly cold. And the fact that you end up rooting for these characters and feel something towards them, aside from just enjoying watching them kill each other, is really, it's just, it was a fascinating take and one that I wasn't necessarily expecting.
Yeah, I thought it was really entertaining, and like I said, I don't think you ever, have a real feel on where the story's going to go or where these characters and how their relationships are going to unfold. I thought it was really underrated funny as well. Throughout from some of Shirley's actions, there's this great scene at this faculty party where she confronts, someone who works at the college who is clearly having a tryst with Stuhlbarg, and it's just great. It's just some really great biting stuff that Shirley does. And I think Stuhlbarg is really funny throughout because, like you said, I think, it's possible. That's what I love about this film is there's a lot that's open to interpretation, including, the ending. I think, he's like, you could interpret him as putting on a performance or because I think he does feel very out of touch. And this is what I fear I will be surrounded by if I end up going for my PhD. A bunch of pretentious fools who just look at the world in a completely different light than I do. Not that I want everyone to look at the world from my perspective, but I think you understand what I mean, especially if you watch this film. I think you'll get a clear sense of that. There's just, like I said, lots of really biting stuff. I really love how, it's almost like we get to see these two, marital situations at different stages in their lives, but how they're, but how a lot of these characters are actually seem to be living, almost parallel lives at a certain point. There's also this great scene towards the end between Stuhlbarg and Moss where, she's finally written her book and he reads it. And I won't say anything more, but he just has some lines that I both thought it was, oh man, that's really cutting. And it's also really funny, darkly funny in a sense. And so, I don't know, I just really enjoyed watching these characters and watching these actors, conflict and combat each other, throughout this unique experience. It's definitely something that's not going to be for everyone and not going to be appreciated by a wide audience, but I think for the right audience, I think you'll definitely really enjoy this. And like I said, I thought the ending was particularly brilliant. I think it's open to interpretation, although, I definitely got what Josephine Decker was going for, and I really want to check out some more of her work, after seeing this out and seeing such a really unique project, to say the least.
Yeah, I was really fascinated by kind of like the interplay that Shirley had, like as she's using Odessa Young kind of as her muse for this new book that she's writing, and how she kind of views Odessa Young's marriage with Logan Lerman as kind of paralleling hers with Michael Stuhlbarg's in a weird way. And how Michael Stuhlbarg is just kind of like how he's morphed into this like petty man. Obviously, he's a womanizer and a philanderer, but he also is like throughout the entire film. And this is why I kind of question is it stupidity or is he just like, trying to blow smoke up his ass? He's always kind of trying to undercut Logan Lerman in so many ways. And there's even one point where he reads his dissertation and he just like absolutely tears it to shreds. And then he goes on this great speech about like how he's offended by mediocrity. It's just like, frighteningly adequate, I think, is one of the phrases that he uses. Just it's those little things, like, as a person who, is trying to pursue better things in his life, those are the kinds of lines that just like kind of stick in you, even if there is no context for anything else from your life in the movie. And I just appreciate that little bit of universality. But the way Michael Stuhlbarg just like shows how that kind of a pursuit can ultimately be hollow and empty and is really, at the end of the day, just to impress the women at that he's teaching. But again, getting back to that kind of interplay between how that the novel that Shirley is writing just mirrors that going on, and watching the marriages do kind of both marriages break down over the course of the film, and reaching a really interesting conclusion to what you mentioned, the ending. I really did appreciate that. But this is also a film that I think I kind of want to, and I don't say this a lot, but I do think I want to rewatch it again so I can kind of take it in a little bit more, because there's like, even as we're talking about it, I'm just like kind of going over things and realizing things that I wasn't even necessarily picking up on while watching it. So this is, Decker has just like such a unique way with revealing information in this that I think it does reward those subsequent viewings. But this is the first thing I've seen from her, but man, it's an absolute home run.
Yeah, I've heard good things about Madeline, or whatever it's called, one of her previous films. So I'm definitely going to check that out, because she just seems like a really, really unique filmmaker. And obviously, we've done a lot of praising of a lot of these actors. But, I was really impressed in particular with Odessa Young as well. And I think, I'm really excited to see where her career goes, because I think, You know, she's clearly an actress that is going places, and I'm really excited just to see where her career goes, because I feel like I never know where Elizabeth Moss is going, and I feel like I see some of that in Odessa Young. So I'm excited to see definitely what she does next. Safe to say the film gets a big recommendation now from both of us, and it's currently streaming on Hulu, so you can definitely check that out if you have a subscription. But it's also available to rent through other video on demand services. With that in mind, we're going to turn our attention to a new segment, and we're planning on this being a weekly segment. You know, Ryan, you know, last week he just texted me, you know, a film question, and it just immediately, you know, I was like, oh, that's a great question, but it just immediately, I was like, oh, we gotta make this a segment, because I just feel like, hey, you know, people seem to really like our longer episodes, and when we're talking about, you know, really interesting film topics, and I think, you know, credit to Ryan for this, as he came up with this question, and now we're just jumping off of that and making this a weekly segment. But essentially, this question of the week, and Ryan can feel free to correct me, if you know, but I basically took it word for word from his text to me, but essentially the question is, what movie do you wish you got to see with a packed theater and a positively reacting crowd at the time of its release? And I'm going to let Ryan go first, because I wrote a bunch of gobbledygook here and I still got to figure it out. So, Ryan, you're up.
So the phrasing of that question is a little weird, because I think that is very much genre dependent. And I was thinking of a very specific film when I thought of this question. Why this film came up in my head, I don't remember. I just don't remember. Since this pandemic, I've been stoned more often than sober. So things just kind of come and go to me. But I'm glad I remembered to ask you this, because there was one movie in particular I was thinking. And, you know, and with the idea being that it's not necessarily a movie you saw in the theater that was empty or that you happened to see on home theater after missing its theatrical run, I was thinking more along the lines of you were too young to see it in the theater in the first place and earlier. So really anything before that. So with that in mind, the film, I don't know why it is. Like, think of it like this. A horror movie, a positive reacting crowd would be like gassing, shrieking, screaming, etc. A comedy, people would be laughing and having, you know, just a good old fashioned chuckle at some of the shit that's going on screen. So the movie I was thinking of, I guess it's some kind of weird combination of both. It is from 1990. It is a film that I saw multiple times on basic cable and VHS. And I don't think I've seen it probably. Oh, God, I can't even tell you how long, because I just can't sit through it. It just makes me squirm that much. I am talking, of course, about Frank Marshall's Arachnophobia, starring Jeff Daniels and John Goodman, which is a film that is basically about a spider from South America that hijacks its way with some kind of shipment to the United States. And then chaos ensues in a small town as the spider ends up breeding with a common house spider. And then super spiders are starting to overrun the whole town. And they used a combination of animatronic spiders and real spiders that they train, so it's like just that much creepier. Like when you're seeing them crawl out of the drain and you know, lurking underneath a lampshade and someone's shoe. But there are just like so many great like build up to jump scares in the film that, and it's obviously meant to be tongue-in-cheek, and John Goodman's character is downright hilarious as the exterminator, just like trying to be badass through all of it. But it's just, you know, there's, and obviously who isn't afraid of spiders? Those fuckers are gross. But, you know, it just like seeing them pop out of nowhere and just like thinking back to the reactions of my mother and my grandmother. And I think one time we watched it and my aunt from San Francisco was watching it with us too. And just like, I remember those reactions of people that I watched it with at home. Wouldn't that have just been a grand old time to sit in the theater and be subjected to that?
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting, because I haven't seen Arachnophobia. Obviously, I know of it, and I'm pretty sure you've mentioned it like to me before somehow. At some point, you know, I've been meaning to check it out, but I'm pretty sure I remember the trailer. I think I saw that when I was young, but I've never seen it. So one of these days, you know, I'll have to get around to it, I guess. But, you know, where I was thinking, of course, you know, first off, you know, my mind went, and I'm just going to list a bunch of films before I get to my final choice. But my first instinct was, well, obviously the cliche answer would be like, you know, Star Wars or Empire for the twist, or, you know, something like Jaws during that summer, or, you know, something like Raiders of the Lost Ark. But then, you know, my mind turned, and then I was thinking of, oh, what about something Kubrick related? And then I was like, well, the thing about Kubrick is a lot of these films that he released, you know, they weren't necessarily to a positively reacting crowd at the time, although that makes me more interested in it. You know, I was fortunate enough to get to see 2001 A Space Odyssey in its original format at a theater last year. And that blew my mind. And I would have loved to see that, you know, just because people were expecting something, you know, in the vein of Star Wars. It's like, oh, no, this is something different, completely different. Or something like A Clockwork Orange, which is very controversial at the time, you know, or The Shining even. And then I was thinking, oh, and then, you know, the horror fan in me was thinking, oh, man, what if I saw Evil Dead 2, or you're going to love this, or I was thinking, oh, what if I saw Halloween 3 Season of the Witch for the reaction of the crowd where they're like, where's Michael? Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I'm going with a film, you know, from certainly to say, you know, an iconic director, you know, a film that certainly fits in, you know, the blockbuster mold, but certainly, you know, was released in a time sort of prior to the big blockbuster summers. And I'm talking about Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest, one of the greatest films ever made. I love Cary Grant to death. I think he remains one of my favorite actors. I think he's so entertaining on screen. And it's just something about it, you know, at that time period when, you know, Alfred Hitchcock was known, you know, and I could have picked a number of his films, honestly. But I'm going to get North by Northwest just because it's just one of those things that I would have loved to have seen, you know, with a crowd for the first time. And, you know, seeing, you know, how, you know, and I think a lot of blockbuster filmmakers took a lot of lessons, you know, from that film. You know, there's a young Martin Landau in the film as one of the heavies. But, you know, just seeing Cary Grant, you know, that iconic scene running from the plane, you know, of course, you know, there's the Mount Rushmore of it all and all that. It's just a really, really fun film, a fun, entertaining film that I think, and it's also one of those films that I think a lot of modern audiences and young people could watch and really enjoy it. And I think it's, you know, not necessarily for its time period. I think a lot of modern audiences would be able to view it through the modern blockbuster prism. And I don't know, that was just something I decided on because, like I said, I mentioned a bunch of films that I could have went for. But I don't know, something about North by Northwest, it just struck me.
There you have it, North by Northwest and Arachnophobia. I have not seen North by Northwest probably since I worked at Hollywood Video. So that was... God, what, 16, 17 years ago at this point. But yeah, I think that's an awesome choice. And you're right. I do think the film is actually a little bit more accessible than some of his other stuff. But I don't know. Hitchcock can be kind of off-putting to a lot of people in a lot of ways. I think it's a case-by-case basis for me, though. I just happen to really like North by Northwest.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's one of his most mainstream for sure. And also, you know, as someone, you know, I've had to teach it, but it's honestly, it's probably still my favorite Hitchcock, which is Strangers on a Train, you know, one of his, you know, American films. And, you know, I've gotten to teach it on a consistent basis on the college level. And it's always interesting to see, you know, most of the students really seem to enjoy it. But I think North by Northwest is one of those films that could be polling, you know, at 100% for a lot of audiences for sure. But with that in mind, like I said, we're going to make this a weekly segment. And with that in mind, what we're going to try and do, obviously this is our first time with it, so what we're going to try and do is pose the question, you know, each episode, you know, sort of ahead of time. And so then we'll discuss this next question. I came up with this, and Ryan doesn't know what it's going to be yet, but I don't know why, but instantly when Ryan and I were talking about this, he came up with this question and we decided on making it a regular segment. I don't know why this question popped into my mind, but it did. And my question that we're going to be discussing next week is, what film would you wipe from existence? Which is, you know, it could take you in many different directions. You know, a film you hate, or a film that was released at the wrong time, or a film that represents something that you passionately are against. But this just jumped into my mind, and I was like, you know, I don't know, something about it just struck me, and I feel like it's going to lead to a really interesting conversation. So yes, Ryan, that is my question. Initial reaction, without spoiling anything that's going through your mind too much right now.
There was only one movie that came to mind, and it's an obvious one, but I'll try to keep it light as possible next week. But there is one movie in particular that came to mind.
All right. Really interesting. Obviously, we could go many different directions with this, so we'll see, you know, what we choose. But from there, obviously, we can turn our attention to our next episode. We're still in the mode of catching up on stuff we missed. So we're finally getting to The Trip to Greece, starring Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon. You know, we're big fans of this series. I'm really excited, you know. You know, it feels like you're literally going on a trip in most of these films, so I'm really excited to check this one out. We're also going to be checking out a film titled Deerskin, starring star of the artist Jean Dujardin, which is from the director of the classic Killer Tire movie from years ago, Rubber. And this one looks fittingly inspired. Saying as it centers on Jean Dujardin's obsession with a deerskin jacket, and it looks quite violent and entertaining, so that's going to be interesting. And Ryan is also wants to cover on this documentary, which I'll let him introduce right now.
That would be Welcome to Chechnya, which is from the filmmakers who brought us How to Survive a Plague, which is about the AIDS crisis in the 80s. Welcome to Chechnya focuses on this activist group in Chechnya that basically helps LGBTQ plus people escape the country. Their human rights record regarding queer individuals is probably worse than Russia's, to be honest. So it's sure to be exactly what I need in these dark and depressing times.
Yeah, clearly the feel-good story of the year. But, you know, obviously fittingly that we're tackling these, you know, very important issues for sure, given the current climate for sure. But, you know, with that in mind, you know, I hope you enjoyed the episode and we'll see you guys next week. And, of course, you know, we posed that question to you guys. You can both answer the question of the week that we answered this week, as well as, you know, think about, you know, this question we're going to be pondering and discussing in next week's episode. And we figured that could lead to some more engagement and some feedback from you guys if you so choose. We may even discuss some of your responses on the podcast if you share them with us. So with that in mind, we'll see you guys next time.